Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 7 Democratic presidential hopefuls will get back in the ring tonight for a debate in Charleston, South Carolina. And to continue the metaphor, the thinking is that gloves will be completely off. Bernie Sanders has expanded his lead. He's expected to draw fire from the other candidates, especially after his comments on 60 Minutes in support of some aspects of the regime of the late Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. Saturday's primary in South Carolina is the first in the South, the first in a state with a significant Black population, and it comes just days ahead of Super Tuesday. Let's bring in NPR political reporter Juana Summers. She's in Charleston. Hi, Juana.
Hey there.
So Sanders won Nevada, New Hampshire, virtual tie in Iowa. How high are the stakes here?
The stakes are incredibly high. Supporters of Senator Sanders tell me if he somehow wins tonight and overtakes Vice President Joe Biden, who's the favorite here in South Carolina, that he would almost have a clear shot to the nomination. It would be very difficult for any other candidate to get into his path and dent that momentum. He has been rising in the polls here, showing significantly more support from the African-American voters that make up about 60% of the Democratic primary electorate. A lot is on the line for Sanders and all of the other candidates who are looking to try to stop him now.
Right. With things like Michael Bloomberg has shared a poll saying that Sanders would hurt the election chances of down ballot Democrats. That's been a big concern. If the word socialist is out there, that might hurt, you know, the local races. New ads by Joe Biden directly attack Sanders. What do they say?
Yeah, that's right. Former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign is out with a new digital ad in South Carolina. It accuses Bernie Sanders of trying to undermine President Obama's reelection campaign by threatening to primary him. In the ad, the narrator says that when it comes to building on Barack Obama's legacy, Bernie Sanders can't be trusted. Now, it's important to note the Sanders campaign has denied that this is true. They say there's no substance of it here. But in a state like this one, where Barack Obama is so widely regarded as the nation's first Black president, it's a very daunting attack, and it's something I expect we'll hear more about in the days ahead of this primary.
Well, and what about Elizabeth Warren? She was certainly on the offense in the Nevada debate, really hit hard on Michael Bloomberg's record. She hasn't attacked Sanders with the same fervor. They have a lot of the same thinking. There was that one moment on the debate stage where they disagreed, you know, after the debate was over, and it was on mic. We heard that. But is she expected to attack him tonight?
I think we're likely to see another aggressive performance from Senator Warren, but I think most of that ire will likely again be directed at Michael Bloomberg. The two have so many inherent philosophical differences in how they approach politics and how they see the world. She and Bernie Sanders, as you noted, Robin, have some very similar views. And when she has critiqued him, it's usually been unsettled things like policies, like where they stand on something like the filibuster. I don't think we'll expect to see a significant broadside there, though, of course, Bernie Sanders is now the front runner, so anything could change.
Well, and let's talk more about the African American vote, because the majority of Democratic voters in South Carolina are Black. And Joe Biden has been saying to his supporters, as he hasn't done well in the previous, caucuses and primaries, he's been saying, this is my firewall. But we've also heard voices saying, don't take us for granted, you know, or words to that effect. You know, the Black community isn't a monolith, but what are you hearing?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I've spent about 2 weeks in South Carolina this month talking to all types of voters and a lot of Black voters. And what I've heard is a sense of pragmatism. The number one thing that most voters tell me when I speak with them is they want to see someone who can defeat Donald Trump in a general election. I have heard concerns from some voters about the fact that Joe Biden is a candidate who has campaigned on the idea of electability, yet he has not clinched a win in any primary. His best chance here comes tonight. This is pretty close to a make or break for his campaign, and a lot of folks in the southern states that follow on Super Tuesday, which are also incredibly diverse, will be watching to see how he performs here.
Now, Pete Buttigieg, he has the second highest delegate count going in the race. He picked up an endorsement from the important South Carolina paper, The State. But many Black voters there are probably aware of the police shooting in his city, South Bend, last summer. It revealed racial tensions there. So talk about now. What's he doing to appeal to them?
So Pete Buttigieg was among the candidates that spoke at a state party dinner that I attended last night. And it's really interesting hearing him talking about how he courts the black vote. He says that running for president is an exercise in humility, that he knows the votes of African Americans were won through struggle and blood, sweat and tears. So he's mindful that when he asks for black votes, it's not a small thing. He's picked up some key endorsements here. And I think they're hoping to prove that he can amass support from communities of color. But so far in the polls, we have not seen him be able to get a significant amount of support from black and brown voters in South Carolina or elsewhere.
But what about Tom Steyer? Now, he didn't qualify for last week's debate, but he's been polling in the double digits in South Carolina. Why? What is his draw there?
Yeah, so Tom Steyer has spent more time on the ground here in South Carolina than any other Democratic candidate. He has spent heavily on ads. He's had a ton of events. He's forging relationships in the community, and I'm told hiring a lot of black vendors and businesses for his events. And that has translated into some support. Many of the polls have him in third place and rising. And this is really his Super Bowl, his best chance so far to make a splash in this race and to make an argument that he should continue to be in it. He's made support from black voters, getting that support kind of the main mission of his campaign.
And we should point out that he has said that he and his wife have both been long involved in philanthropic issues that affect the black community. This isn't something new that he's doing for this campaign.
That's absolutely right.
But Juana Summers, you got about 30 seconds. I mean, is anyone tonight going to attack Donald Trump?
I think you will hear some of the candidates try to turn the page to that. You heard this in the last debate from Michael Bloomberg, who made the case that we're spending a lot of time talking about each other, not enough time talking about the person that most Democratic voters want to see out of the White House.
Yeah.
I think you'll hear that contrast from the candidates as well. But before they get to Donald Trump, they've got to win a primary.
NPR political reporter Juana Summers, thank you.
Thank you.
As the coronavirus spreads around the world, we want to take a look now at the toll the virus is taking on healthcare workers. In China, the place where it all began, a third doctor in Wuhan has died from the virus. He was only 29. For more, let's bring in Sui Li Wei, who is a reporter for The New York Times in Singapore. Sui Li, welcome.
Thank you.
And one of the most perplexing aspects of this coronavirus is why, in addition to people who may have other health conditions and people who are very young or very old, it's also hitting doctors and nurses who appear to be otherwise healthy. We recall the whistleblower doctor who died. He was just 34 years old, and now this most recent doctor is only 29. Do we have a sense of why these doctors and healthcare workers are dying from this?
So the Chinese government isn't giving a lot of information on this. We know during SARS that a lot of it happened when the doctors and nurses were intubating the patients. And that was a function of you know, the 15% of infections we saw among medical workers. This time we don't know. We can only speculate that a lot of public health experts have said that a lot of these doctors and nurses have weaker immune systems because they are working in a healthcare environment. And this could be the cause for the infections.
Probably not getting a lot of sleep. And it's probably a very stressful situation for them. Maybe that's wearing down their immune systems. The official count a week ago was that nearly 2,000 healthcare workers were thought to be infected. Do we have any update on that figure?
No, they've stuck to that figure. Yesterday, they came out with a figure that it was 3,000, but that actually includes suspected cases and other cases that they haven't confirmed yet.
Your reporting found major shortages of masks, that doctors were begging or borrowing them for friends, using tape to patch up holes, reusing goggles that were supposed to be thrown out. Is this a sign that basically supplies just can't get through to these healthcare workers?
Yes, they are very, very short of what they call personal protective equipment, masks, goggles, and safety gowns. And a lot of it is because of the numbers, you know, the surge, the numbers that we're dealing with in China are unprecedented. And, you know, the number of doctors and nurses on the front line trying to fight this epidemic. But a lot of it is also due to government policy. In the early days of the lockdown that was happening in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, a lot of roads were closed off and truck drivers had to take their temperatures 14 times. And so a lot of that delay led to these medical supplies not getting to the doctors and nurses.
Some of the doctors have taken to social media saying they feel helpless. What are you hearing from the healthcare workers?
Yeah, pretty much the same. No one has said that they want to quit yet, which is pretty remarkable. But they are tired, really stressed. There are hotlines for them to talk about their mental health. All of them are working 24/7.
Sweetly, are you getting a sense from the people that you're talking to as this outbreak continues that they're frustrated with the Chinese government and its response?
Yes, there is a lot of anger about the lockdowns that were taken. The Chinese government decided to seal off cities without any notice. They've decided to shut down schools and businesses. And the biggest outcry really came about a couple of weeks ago when, you know, a young doctor called Li Wenliang died, and he was known as the whistleblower doctor. But really, he didn't really fit the original, you know, description of whistleblower. He was telling his friends in a private chat group that there were a couple of patients with SARS in his hospital. Hmm. And when he died, that ignited a huge outcry in the country, a reaction that I've never seen before in my 10 years of being in China.
That is Sweetly Wee, who is a reporter for The New York Times, joining us from Singapore. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You might know Nick Kroll from his very raunchy animated show on Netflix, Big Mouth.
Are you the puberty fairy?
The puberty fairy? I'm the hormone monster. I'm not a fairy.
Well, now he's starring as a romantic lead in a movie set at the Olympics. Actor and comedian Nick Kroll, next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
As China faces the crisis caused by COVID-19, a human rights crisis caused by the Chinese government continues. I'm talking about abuse and detainment of the Uyghurs, a Muslim minority group in the Xinjiang region of China. The Trump administration has criticized the Chinese government, as have senators of both parties, including Republican Marco Rubio.
I will never accept the notion that somehow, in order to be able to sell them more things, we have to look the other way on some of the grotesque human rights violations that we're seeing systemized on their part.
And Democrat Mark Warner.
When America doesn't make part of its foreign policy human rights, individual liberty, freedom of expression, we lose our moral force.
Joining us now is Bill Kirby, professor of business and China studies at Harvard. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
So take a step back, first of all. Who are the Uyghurs?
The Uyghurs are a historically Turkish people who live in what is now the northwestern quadrant of the People's Republic of China. It was brought into the Qing Empire. They conquered it, although they ruled it rather differently than it has been ruled under Chinese republics. It had a very brief period of what you might call independence or autonomy in the 1930s and 1940s. Otherwise, in the 20th century, it has been under Chinese governance, and particularly since the communist conquest of Xinjiang, under the People's Republic of China. I think one of the great tensions that you see playing out right now is whether it should be ruled with a great deal of autonomy, as the Qing did to a considerable degree, mm-hmm. or whether it should be made Chinese and part of the new nation state of China that succeeded the empire.
Well, it seems like Beijing's decision has been to go the latter route there and try to make it more Chinese.
Much more so, and much more so over the last several years than really at any point in the history of the People's Republic. Under the leadership of the party secretary of Xinjiang, a guy named Chen Quanguo, there is an attempt really to sinicize Xinjiang, perhaps above all in a form of cultural and ideological transformation of the Uyghur people.
Well, and a crackdown is the word that some have used. We know they've been building these re-education camps, internment camps, and detaining as many as a million ethnic Uyghurs or more. What does the crackdown look like? What do we know about what's happening?
Well, it's everywhere in the region to the degree that we know that you have not only a million Uyghurs will have been in these camps. That's 10% of the population, and assuming that the majority of them are male, perhaps 20% of the male population. And this harkens back to the harsh nature of early communist rule throughout the country in the 1950s and the system of what was called in Chinese Laogai, of reform through neighbor camps, in which as many as 40 million people across China, or 5% of the entire population, were put in one form of incarceration or another. But beyond the incarceration, there is the tracking of people, the surveillance of individuals, both old-fashioned Soviet and East German-style surveillance, plus modern technological advances in surveillance being employed. Even household goods, such as kitchen knives, have to be registered with the government.
Would you say that every single Uyghur is either incarcerated or being surveilled by the government?
Well, I wouldn't. You know, we're not close enough to be able to make that judgment. But there is certainly the capacity, it appears, to do that. And you don't have to incarcerate every single one of them or to listen to the calls of every single one of them to have a massive intimidating effect on the entire population.
What about the nearly 500,000 kids who have been separated from their families and put into boarding schools? What is happening in these schools?
Those schools, to the degree that has been reported about them, are a means of education in largely Mandarin Chinese as part of the effort to make individuals into Chinese citizens and to move away from a Uyghur ethnic identity. And it has been reported to move them away from their Muslim religious identity.
Is it fair to compare it to other events in history, even the Holocaust?
No, I don't think that's a fair comparison here. We're not dealing with mass murder. We're not dealing with premeditated extermination of individuals. You're dealing with an effort to make them Chinese and to crack down hard on what the Chinese fear is the capacity for terrorism, anti-Chinese terrorism in the region. It's fair to note that earlier in the last decade, several hundred Chinese were murdered by small terrorist groups or at least violent groups in Xinjiang. And the major crackdown effort has had as a result no significant pushback from the population in core China. Many Chinese friends tell me they don't necessarily like these techniques, but now, as one of my friends put it, quote, we feel safe, end quote.
What about the U.S.? What has the U.S. done so far? We've heard comments like those from Marco Rubio.
Yep.
Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has said China is home to one of the worst human rights crises of our time, the stain of the century. What has the U.S. said and what has the U.S. done about it?
What the U.S. has done is to join other countries, some 22 countries, in a joint statement to the U.N. Human Rights Council, calling on China to end its policy of mass arbitrary detentions. And the U.S. placed 28 Chinese public security bureaus and companies on our entity list. This is really much more symbolic than real, in effect, blacklisting them in the United States due to their involvement in this surveillance. And the Congress passed the Uyghur Act of 2019 in December that directs the government to impose sanctions and export restrictions related to China's treatment of the Uyghurs. What that actually will mean, in fact, I think remains to be seen. You have different messages on questions of human rights in China coming from Secretary Pompeo, who has been very tough on this issue, and from President Trump, who has said nothing on this issue.
Do you think the U.S. could be doing more or could have an effect if it did do more?
I think it's very unlikely, actually, that it would have a large effect, except for the effect of embarrassment, which is important. China takes seriously its reputation in the world. It is a country that has sought over the last decades to build up its soft power and its reputation as an advanced, technologically advanced and modernizing country. And the leaks of the Xinjiang papers published by the New York Times that laid bare the nature of this naked crackdown have been seriously embarrassing to the regime. Those are probably in many ways more effective in embarrassing the regime than critique from the United States, whose own record in human rights the Chinese are very quick to criticize.
Bill Kirby, this is the first conversation we've had about China in quite some time that is not about the coronavirus, but we should talk about that because is the Uyghur population at risk from this virus? Does it affect what's going on with the Uyghurs?
So far, very, very good effect. It has been centered in core China, but in the far-flung areas of the empire, such as Xinjiang and Tibet, no significant effect so far.
More broadly, do you think that the coronavirus, COVID-19, is having an effect on the government in Beijing that a number of other crises, whether it be this or the trade war with the United States, have not had, putting more pressure on them?
I think it's put enormous pressure on the government. You have a kind of a stunningly quick critique of Chinese policy in China as well as outside of China, but largely in China, blaming the government for sitting on the news of this new virus. And there is a great deal of political pressure on the government to control this and to control it fast, which has led in turn to unprecedented efforts of the control of the movement of individuals everywhere in the main core areas of China. I have a friend whose parents live in the north coastal province of Shandong, far away from this virus, in a town where there are none infected and none nearby. And yet her parents are not allowed to leave their apartment without a hall pass signed by the local party committee.
One more thing I want to ask you about, and it just seems like some of these stories get connected in ways that we didn't anticipate. The situation in Hong Kong, we've had this protest movement going on for many months in a pretty serious way now. And has the coronavirus, which has shut the border to a certain degree between mainland China and Hong Kong, has that had any effect on the protest movement?
I think the virus has had an effect on the protest movement to the degree that individuals are not gathering in public in large numbers. It may reinforce from the point of view of some that there are great dangers of being associated with mainland China. But I think actually for the majority of individuals in Hong Kong, it's a time of solidarity. The real suffering, I think, and this is something we should all take a step back, this should be a time of concern and condolence for the 70,000 almost exclusively Chinese individuals who have this virus, and condolence for the 2,000 families who have lost a loved one to it. And I think in Hong Kong and in other parts of the Chinese cultural sphere, including Chinese communities around the world, there is great concern for their loved ones and a sense of solidarity in this fight.
That is Bill Kirby, a professor of business and China studies at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Jeremy.
There are two new surveys that find people are souring on the tech industry. A Pew Research report finds about half of tech experts predict technology will weaken democracy over the next decade, citing concerns about the decline of journalism and the impact of surveillance capitalism. And the public relations firm Edelman also found a sharp decline in public trust in technology in its annual Trust Barometer report. For more, we're joined from San Francisco by Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the Pew report that asked tech experts about their concerns. What were they?
So I think the concern is that the pace of technology advancement is outpacing our ability to fact check it, to tell what's real and what's not. And we've seen this already crop up, and this is before the advanced technology gets here. There's a lot of talk about deepfakes, where a video purports to be something it isn't. What we see now are usually cheap fakes, which are obviously faked. And by obvious, I don't mean that it won't fool anyone. I just mean that we can clearly tell. When we really get to deepfakes, it will be very hard to tell whether what we're seeing is real or not. So when you take advances like this, I think a lot of people think it's going to be easier for the rich and powerful and harder for truth to win out.
And what about the Edelman Trust Barometer? What does that say about tech?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, I think the clearest thing is that tech confidence in the trust of these companies is declining. It's not a gigantic drop, and tech by and large is still respected more than other industries, but it's significant and notable. We've been talking for a couple of years now about this idea of a tech lash, a backlash against the tech industry, but mostly that's been coming from activists, from policy people, and we've been wondering, when is it going to be a groundswell? When is it going to be affecting the average consumer who, by and large, likes the free things they get from Facebook and Google? And I think we're starting to see some of that. It's not huge, but it's noticeable, it's measurable, and it's a big deal because I think for some of these more radical policies, if, you know, people who talk about breaking up tech companies, for that to happen, you're going to need some popular support. So I think that would be the worrying thing to me if I were one of these tech companies.
But as a person, in addition to a journalist in this story, I would say I don't trust the tech companies. But at the same time, I always click accept when they ask me to do the terms and conditions. And you probably do too, Ina.
I do, because we don't have a choice. And I think, you know, that's the question, is whether legislatively, regulatory, can we get more choice? Can we decide what of our personal information we are willing to share versus sort of the accept all that we've all clicked? Basically, I think the world has clicked okay. I think, you know, especially led by Europe, but to some degree in the U.S., people are saying, wait, should we have more agency? Should we be able to say, yes, I want a Gmail account. No, I don't want you to have every bit of information about me.
Do you think we're going to see more laws on the state or federal level that might improve public trust in technology?
I do think we're seeing a lot of movements at the state level. I think, you know, in an election year, in a very divided Congress, even though there are people on both the right and the left that favor legislation, for a long time, it looked like we might get national privacy legislation. That's looking less likely, but we are seeing a lot at the state level. In the absence of federal action, states like California, but not just California, are passing their own laws. And when a state as big as California does it, it actually becomes de facto national policy, and that's something we've written about.
That is Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent for Axios, joining us from San Francisco. Ina, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It is Black History Month, and we have an appropriate story about a woman with a storied past. A street is named after her in Chicago. There's a 1990 commemorative stamp from the Postal Service. She was a suffragette, a mom to four, and a reporter in the late 1800s who survived death threats to expose a dark chapter in history. Her name is Ida B. Wells, and David Freudberg of the public radio series Humankind has her story.
Ida Barnett Wells was born to enslaved parents on a plantation in Holly Springs, Mississippi in 1862 as the Civil War raged. After emancipation, her mother learned to read by accompanying young Ida to school. Paula Giddings at Smith College wrote the principal biography of Ida B. Wells.
Her father was illiterate, but he would ask her to read the newspaper to him and to his friends. His friends would gather around and ask her to read the newspaper to them.
For Wells, it was an early lesson in the importance of information and the power of the press. Originally employed as a school teacher, she began her journalistic life in her early 20s, writing for African American newspapers. And by age 29, she was part owner of the Memphis Free Speech newspaper, which would reach an audience of Black readers. Here an actor reads from her autobiography.
I had an instinctive feeling that the people who have little or no school training should have something coming into their homes weekly, which dealt with their problems in a simple, helpful way. So I wrote in a plain, common sense way on the things that concerned our people.
But Wells did not shrink from covering the prejudice that hobbled African Americans after the Civil War. Attorney and civil rights activist Brian Stevenson is founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama.
You know, there were a handful of people who, as a result of education, were capable of seeing and understanding things that a lot of people couldn't see and understand. Ida B. Wells could read anything, and she consumed information from all kinds of sources to gain a perspective on the problem that was much more comprehensive, much more nuanced than a lot of other folks.
And events forced Wells to confront the rampant domestic terrorism against African Americans that would claim thousands of victims starting in the late 19th century.
So if the aha moment for her is when a very good friend of hers by the name of Thomas Moss is lynched in Memphis, Tennessee.
Historian Paula Giddings says the brazen slaying of Thomas Moss in 1892 had a profound impact on the young journalist.
And Thomas Moss is no criminal. He's a virtuous Memphis citizen. He was operating a store called the People's Grocery. By night, by day, he was a postman. And that's how he and Wells met, because he was on her route when she was a newspaper editor. Became very good friends. In fact, she was the godmother for his baby, he and his wife's child, youngest child. And that People's Grocery, which was a symbol of so much that was going on with blacks and black economic development in Memphis, Tennessee, was competing with a white store in the area. And the white proprietor took advantage of some racial tension in the area to bring sheriffs to the area.
It was in this atmosphere that a number of racial scuffles took place, erupting into a shootout. Thomas Moss and two men in the People's Grocery were blamed and taken to jail.
Even then, it's assumed that they'll have a trial. They said that they were shooting in self-defense, which they were. But on the night of March 9th, some like 75 masked men, white men, come into the jail, snatch out the three men, Thomas Moss and two of the men working in the grocery, take them out into an abandoned railway yard, and just horribly torture them and kill them.
And this incident, Ida Wells later wrote, changed the whole course of my life. The anti-lynching cause became her personal crusade, and it transformed her into what today we would call an investigative reporter. Wells went on to write a series of impassioned editorials inveighing against the hangings, burnings, and shootings. Brian Stevenson says she demanded accountability for the perpetrators.
She, unlike some emancipated black folks, decided to speak very critically of what was going on. There were people who encouraged her to be less vocal about it, and she said, I won't. And you have to admire and be incredibly inspired by someone who takes seriously this idea of speaking truth to power. And that's what's unique about Ida B. Wells' writing.
The Afro-American is not a bestial race. If this work can contribute in any way towards proving this, and at the same time arouse the conscience of the American people to a demand for justice to every citizen and punishment by law for the lawless, I shall feel I have done my race a service.
First of all, you know, she's small. She's like about 5 feet tall. She's a tiny woman. And she starts just traveling alone. She's traveling to the sites of lynchings. She's interviewing eyewitnesses. She begins to put together statistics and also use statistics of other organizations, like the Chicago Tribune was actually also looking at lynchings and were publishing statistics. And statistics is a relatively new innovation in this period of time. But she knew that she had to use more than opinion to have actual evidence of what was happening.
She spoke to the abdication of the rule of law, and really tried to compel people to accept and to recognize their responsibility in this crisis. For that, she was obviously targeted and herself the object of a lot of threat and menace.
As soon as she started writing anti-lynching editorials, she says herself in her autobiography that she bought a pistol, thinking that people were going to kill her. And she said, well, if I go, somebody's going to go with me. That was her attitude.
Wells learned tenacity early in life. Both her parents and a younger brother died in a yellow fever epidemic when she was 16. She then assumed the task of raising her five remaining siblings and carried that personal strength into her battle against lynching.
There was an editorial that she wrote in May of 1892. Which was published when she wasn't in town. But she goes to New York, where she's met by T. Thomas Fortune, who is the leading black newspaperman in the country at this point, with his newspaper out of New York, the New York Age. And she meets him at the train station And he says, well, we've been trying to get you here for some time, Miss Wells, and now that you're here, you're going to have to stay. And she says, what are you talking about? He says, oh, you haven't heard. Well, they have destroyed in Memphis, after the publication of the editorial, they have destroyed her newspaper office. They have run her business partner out of town. She has heard now that they're also planning to, they're waiting for her to come back so that they can lynch her.
Wells considered going back. In many southern towns, local fraternal groups would form militias to look after African-American residents. And one in Memphis had sent word that they would protect her.
But she decided, she said, going back would just mean more bloodshed, as she says, and more widows. She said, no, I'm not going to do it. So she's now in exile, and she won't have another trip back to the South in decades.
At one point, following the racial murder of a black postmaster in South Carolina, Wells met with President William McKinley at the White House, along with members of Congress and pastors calling for justice. Ultimately, the lynchers were never punished. But her example of fearless journalism is inspiring to a new generation.
There weren't a lot of templates for what I wanted to do. I didn't grow up seeing any ideas or any examples of black women investigative reporters.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a correspondent focusing on racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. She leads the 1619 Project, which recognizes 400 years since slavery was introduced in the Americas. Ever since first learning about Ida B. Wells, Nicole was emboldened.
I think about her a lot, and I really do think she guides my work because she had such a strong sense of what was right and what was wrong. So clearly, that's why my Twitter name is Ida B. Wells, in honor of her.
In our era when investigative journalism is a safeguard of democracy, the unlikely role model of this tiny woman stands tall today. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
In his press conference in New Delhi today, President Trump was asked about his tweet yesterday saying that Supreme Court Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg should recuse themselves from future cases involving the Trump administration because of past comments from Ginsburg and a recent dissent written by Sotomayor.
I just don't know how they can not recuse themselves for anything having to do with Trump or Trump-related. The right thing to do is that.
The right thing to do is that, he said. Emily Bazelon is here to unpack. She's staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So let's take a deep breath on this case that was at the center. This Sotomayor wrote the dissent in the case that the Supreme Court took on request for emergency relief. This was the administration asking the court to stay a lower court's decision that would block the administration's public charge rule. This is the policy that would turn away immigrants who were likely to need public benefits like food stamps and Medicaid. But put that particular case aside, what did Sotomayor say about the administration's use of these emergency relief requests?
Yeah, Sotomayor's concern here is about procedure. The government has been coming to the court more frequently than in past administrations and asking for what's called emergency relief. And to get that relief, it means the government has to show irreparable harm. Either we get to put this public charge rule into effect or something terrible is going to happen. And when the government gets this kind of emergency relief, it means that you upend the normal process in the lower courts where the courts hear a case on the merits and then it comes to the Supreme Court. And so Sotomayor's concern is that the Supreme Court has become so apt to grant these emergency stays that it's effectively eroding its own fair and balanced decision-making process. That was what she said. And she was comparing the government saying, we're going to have this terrible harm to us if we can't stop approving more green card applications from citizens, green card applications from immigrants for citizenship. She was comparing that to the same standard for blocking an execution, which the court has been much less likely to grant.
Well, and, you know, some legal analysts are agreeing with her. Stephen Vladeck, a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, was quoted by The Washington Post. He did a study. He found that Trump's solicitor general sought these emergency stays in 20 cases in the first 2.5 years of President Trump's term. compared to all 16 years of both the Obama and George W. Bush administrations when the Solicitor General filed a total of 8 stay applications, so 8 to 20, it would seem that her point that they are being used quite a bit is true.
Right. And I think what you see, the underlying concern here is about the politicization of the Supreme Court and the idea that the Trump administration sees a strong conservative majority and wants to leapfrog over the normal processes of the lower courts in a way that gives it an advantage in the Supreme Court.
Well, yesterday, the president's tweet also referred to a Fox News segment that was titled, Sotomayor accuses GOP-appointed justices of being biased in favor of Trump. Now, this is referring to the fact that in her dissent, she also criticized her colleagues. She didn't call them her conservative or GOP-appointed colleagues, but she said that her colleagues were acquiescing too much to these administration requests.
Right. And I think what you see here from Trump is that, as is often the case, he sees offense as the best defense. So he made this broad call for recusal. In the meantime, there's a news story in The New York Times about how the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, Ginni Thomas, has been trying to influence Trump's appointments in the National Security Council and other parts of the government. And so there have been calls in response to that story for Justice Thomas to also recuse himself. Yeah. So you see President Trump changing the subject.
Yeah. Well, and we also must note that the president also criticized Justice Ginsburg. That was because during the 2016 election, when he was a candidate, she called Donald Trump a faker. She later apologized, said her comments were ill-advised. So how do you view both of these statements, one public, one a dissent? Or how would the legal world be looking at this call for recusal?
Well, I think these are different things. Sotomayor wrote a kind of garden variety legal argument in her dissent in which she was not making a political point. She was worried about the court's own processes and safeguarding them. I think what you see from Justice Ginsburg's remarks, which she made outside the courtroom, as she said, it's ill-advised for a Supreme Court justice to be commenting on the president like that. This other question of what it takes to recuse yourself, Supreme Court justices have refused to do that broadly for many years. I mean, Justice Scalia famously went duck hunting with Vice President Cheney, refused to recuse himself. There is no overlord for the Supreme Court. They get to make these decisions themselves. And the notion that they would take themselves out of all of the cases involving the federal government is pretty far-fetched.
Yeah. And Emily, we want to note that there is a lot else going on at the Supreme Court. The court agreed yesterday to hear a case on same-sex couples and foster care. And there is a big abortion case which is going to be heard next week. We will, of course, be all over that, as will you. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. Oh, by the way, her cover piece this weekend, The Originalist, looks at how conservative legal ideas are impacting abortion, LGBTQ rights, and gun control. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Kevin Parker is the man behind Tame Impala. He writes, records, and produces all the music. We'll talk with him in his first ever NPR interview about his latest album, which he hopes will get you to dream about your life.
Because that was always something that I loved when I was a kid. It was that music that just kind of made my life make sense.
That's next time on Here and Now.